Today is August 19th, 1986. The following interview is with Ben Waldman, W-A-L-D-M-A-N. Mr. Waldman was an associate director in the Office of Presidential Personnel. The interview will take place in room 80 of the old executive office building. Well, to start with, how long have you actually been on the White House staff? Do you remember approximately when you joined?
Yeah, I joined at the end of September in 1985. So I've been on just about a year, about 11 months now.
How was it that you came to join the White House staff?
Bob Tuttle, I was working at HUD. Bob Tuttle asked me if I'd like to join the White House staff because George Armstrong was leaving.
So, in effect, you took George Armstrong's place, is that right, then? Okay. In general terms, what's the mission of the Office of Presidential Personnel? When somebody that doesn't know a thing about the White House asks you that question, without spending hours on it, how do you respond to that?
Fairly simply, the Office of Presidential Personnel is in charge of recruiting and screening candidates for jobs that the President is charged with filling. Those jobs that are nominally known as Schedule C jobs, SES, non-career jobs, and PA and PAS jobs, presidentially appointed with Senate confirmation jobs.
Approximately how many positions throughout the government fall into this category? I've heard different figures. What do you have a figure that comes to mind that you use?
You're looking at probably about from 3,000 to 4,000 Schedule C jobs, another 800 to 1,000 SES jobs. I don't know how many PAs or PASs there are. I think 600 PASs. PAs are difficult because a lot of them are boards and commissions. They're not real full-time jobs.
Okay. That at least gives us a broad idea of the number of positions you folks might be responsible for.
In addition, we help screen candidates for the 15,000 or so positions on secretarial boards and commissions.
This is being done by a staff of approximately how many?
40.
40 people. Does that number vary very much? Has it varied very much, Ben, as far as you know?
35 to 40.
35 to 40.
Yeah, it's down from, I think, probably more than 50 or 60 in the first administration.
I've handed you a page out of the telephone directory that lists, I guess, the senior members of the Office of Presidential Personnel. For the sake of the record, if you could touch upon who those people are, giving first their name and a brief description of what their responsibility is, I think that'll help kind of fill in the picture.
Okay, first on the list is Robert Tuttle. He, of course, is the head of presidential personnel. He directs the office. He is the focal point for all decisions on personnel matters in the office. He, of course, hires and fires everybody in the office, but also works with each associate director to go over their area of vacancy, find out what vacancies there are, get with the department or agency head, the secretary or the administrator, or the appropriate designee of that person, and decide on who, what kind of person, and who they think can best fill that job. He really manages the day-to-day operations, and then every once a week, generally, he goes to the president with candidates for those jobs, and the president will choose from among a list of two or three that we've narrowed it down to.
Okay.
Now, sometimes we'll narrow it down to less than that, and the president will either choose them or deny them, and then we go back and start over again.
Okay, that's good for Tuttle. How about Maureen Zatarga?
Maureen Zatarga is just, she's Bob's EA, executive assistant. She really doesn't do any personnel work per se. She's there just to handle Bob's administrative matters.
Okay.
Gina Kormanek is Bob's special assistant. She's his liaison to all the rest of the associates. If he needs to delegate work or whatever, it would go through Gina.
Okay.
Catherine Bedell is listed as a staff assistant. She's actually now an associate director. She has taken over the role of associate director for boards and commissions, and she does all presidentially appointed boards and secretarial boards. And presidential boards would be anything from Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, post. She didn't. I don't think she did postal board of governors. Some of those, that, you know, the more important type boards too. President's board on physical fitness. You know, those type of boards that are not policy related but are more advisory type. And then she also does all the secretarial boards. Brenda Jones is just clerical staff for Bob. Amy Weiss wasn't a clerical person for Bob, took Catherine's place as staff assistant, and what she handles is all the paperwork relating to appointments. Susan Borchert has been on medical leave the whole time I've been here. She was the head of recruiting, and then was somebody replaced her in that job, and then she fell ill, and so she's been on medical leave, so I can't tell you what her role is exactly.
Fine.
And Foreman is the associate director in charge of foreign policy type jobs. She handles jobs at defense, USIA, state, AID, ACTA, and any. She puts together delegations, UNGA, and she does all ambassadors. Susan Phillips handles what we would classify as the physical resources of the country, interior, energy, agriculture. In addition, she has Small Business Administration, General Services Administration, and a whole host of smaller type of boards and agencies. Consumer Product Safety Commission is under her purview, and some of the other smaller ones. Kathy Regan handles human resources. She does Department of Labor, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, Education. National Labor Relations Board, National Labor Relations Authority, those things that would deal with human resources. Mark Sullivan handles judicial and business, so he has Justice, Treasury, Commerce, Federal Home Loan Bank Board, Office of Management and Budget, those type of agencies. I'm next, so I'll just skip over.
Yeah, skip yourself for the time being.
Ann Banning, down as Director of Recruiting, she's actually been promoted to Associate Director in charge of recruiting. She's our in-house headhunter. There's a technical job that needs to be filled that we don't have people for. She goes out and searches. Katja Bullock is down as Director of Information Computer Center. She's also been promoted. She is Associate Director for Computer Centers Information, and she handles all of the information and paper flow that goes through and around personnel, and she's charged with making sure that the computer center is up and running at all times.
I can't tell you how important that information is, because you very frequently don't get it, in part because everyone assumes, well, everybody knows what these folks do, but 50 years from now, that will be information that will be difficult to pick up, and I'm very impressed with how much you know about each one. That in itself tells somebody about how tight the Presidential Personnel Office is, that one person can sit here and recite all of the different agencies that the other people are responsible for. Frankly, I'm surprised. I wouldn't have expected that you would know that much about what everyone else does, given the mission of the office being as broad as it is and what have you. Well, let's zero in then on Ben Waldman. What was his responsibility?
I was charged with what was called the Congressional Political Operation. And in addition, because coincidentally, the day that I started was the day after Susan Borchert fell ill, I was given part of her shop, which was the Schedule C clearances. And so we'll take that in reverse order. On Schedule C clearances, my job was to receive all the vacancies, the vacancy notifications, that is to say the vacancy forms from the agencies, and to go through our list of candidates that would come through our office and pick out from that list people who would fill those vacancies for Schedule C jobs. So, for instance, we might get a job, a vacancy report that would say Department of Agriculture needs an economist, preferably with a law degree from a Midwestern state who understands ag labor. And in fact, we did get a job for him just like that. And what we were charged with doing is finding somebody who has supported the president, who understands the president's agenda, and has all the technical qualifications that are required by the Department of Agriculture. And so what we do is we would then search through the computer and find if there's anybody who meets some of those criteria. And in addition, I met with each of the deputies of the other associates 3 times a week, and we would just go over vacancy forms. And then people would say, oh, I know this person, or this person's there, and he's a GS-13 now, but he's been there for 3 years, and this is a GS-14 job, and it'd be a good step up for him. Let's send him over and see how they would do. Now, presidential personnel does not hire anybody. What we do is we screen candidates and send them to the agencies, and then the agencies decide whether or not to hire. So it was our charge in terms of Schedule C operation to try and match people in vacancies, and then let the agencies go ahead and do the interviewing and the hiring. That worked out all right, except that most of the time the agencies, when they send over a vacancy form, had it in their mind as to who they wanted to hire already, and where you would get a very technical form that would, one would say, it needs to be an ag laborer, somebody with a law degree from Midwestern State, it would just so happen that on the bottom of the form where it would say suggested candidates, there'd be somebody with just those qualifications. Surprise, surprise, what a coincidence. And then we'd send over 3 people and they'd say, well, they're not as qualified as the person we sent you. And so that's how the give and take goes between the agencies and the departments.
The computer that you mentioned that you researched for, how did the names get into the computer bank?
The process works as follows. Congressman John Doe sends in his constituent, Bill Smith, and says to, Dear Mr. President, I'm sending you the resume of Bill Smith, my constituent, who is perfectly qualified to have a job in your administration. He's been a great fan of yours, although he didn't vote for you, and he just found out your name 2 weeks ago, but he'd really like to serve in your administration. And so they send us the resume. We send a letter back to the congressman saying, thank you for recommending Bill Smith, and we're going to get in touch with him. And then we would also send Bill Smith a letter saying, thanks for your interest in serving the administration. We need the following information. And then we'd list off some of the things that we needed, from date of birth, social security number, voting address, did he vote in 1984, what party was he registered, when did he... we called that the white letter. When that letter comes back in, we then would go through it and verify the information they put down on that form with people that we knew. The person who's in charge of verifying that information is Tag Tognelli, who's not on this, who actually is probably one of the key cogs in the whole machinery, because without Tag, none of it would really work properly. And so he's a key person in the whole personnel system. And Tag knows literally the top 200 people by a first name basis in the country who have worked in the parties, probably 250 or 300, in each of the states. So Tag could call any state and tell you the party chairman's name, the Reagan chairman name in 84, and the Reagan chairman name in 80, and in some states the Reagan chairman from 1976, and then can also tell you about who else is in the state. So if Bill Smith is in John Doe's district and John Doe is in southern Florida, Tag would know who to call in southern Florida to say, who's Bill Smith? He said he worked, he stuffed envelopes. Did he really stuff envelopes? And then if he did, then we say, okay, he's not a liar, and we'll leave it up to the FBI to find out whether he's a felon or not. But so then now he goes into the computer, and we codify on that computer those things that he has put down on the resume as being key: education, experience, previous job, and then interest. Say, I'm interested in serving at Commerce, I'm interested in legal, I'm interested in foreign policy, I'm interested in being the president's, bellhop. And we would key those in, except for the last one, which we don't have a key code for. And then if at a later date we need somebody who has the interests in the background that he has told us, we can do a computer search and pull it up. There's currently about 80,000 names on the computer. The computer system's only about 2 years old, I think. At the beginning of the administration, we probably lost at least an equal number of names in terms of resumes being lost, thrown out. I mean, there are people who tell stories of, we sent in the resume, they said send another one. We sent it in, they said send another one. We went through 8 resumes. And those 8 resumes are here in presidential personnel somewhere, but just nobody can locate them. So the computer system has helped quite a bit.
Thank you for that. That, too, is one of those bits of information that 50 years from now, I'm sure will be of interest to people. No one has sat down and explained it as you did.
Well, this is the first time that any of it's been computerized. Now, it needs to be computerized in the next administration. I'm sure they'll upgrade the computer system. Because between the time that's been developed and now, we're time sharing on a VAX or a DEX system. I think it's a VAX system. And the technology exists today with the type of optical storage technology that we could have it all up on a local area network and we wouldn't have to go into this, but and we could retrieve it all a lot better and a lot faster. But I'm sure the next administration will upgrade that system. This is the first step to a good retrieval system.
I caused you to sidetrack on that, and I apologize, and I unfortunately didn't put down a note as to what you were talking about when I interrupted you to explain that. You were talking about the process with Schedule C people, and
I think I probably covered. I think I was telling you that if this we're talking about vacancies in the Schedule C process, and I think the next thing I was going to tell you was about the congressional, the second part of my job, which is congressional political. If any congressman, senator, governor, state representative, state senator, party official at the state, national, local, or precinct level, anybody who calls themselves a political representative, even if it's a precinct chairman, if they write, call, or otherwise communicate with the White House, the President, the Chief of Staff, or the head of presidential personnel, I'm generally charged, and there are specific exceptions, but I'm generally charged with corresponding back with that person. And most of that's done by computer. Saginaw County Chairman, Michigan, writes in to say, I recommend this person for that job. It is my office's job, take the letter in, make sure the job's not filled. If it is, we send back a letter saying, thanks for your input, but regretfully we've chosen somebody. To make sure that that person is in the system. If they're not, we then put them through the clearance system. And then once we've done that, then we are charged with writing back to them and saying, thanks for your input. We've started this through the system. Once it's out of the system, it gets kicked back to our office because that's where it came from. Okay, this person who was recommended. Then we send a copy over to the office. If this person was being recommended for Human Development Services, Assistant Secretary at Health and Human Services, we would first send them through the clearance system, then send the letter and the resume to Kathy Russo, who, it was on here as Kathy Regan. It's now Kathy Russo. She got married actually on Christmas Day. I would send it over to Kathy Russo and say, it actually goes very automatically. And then she'd see where it came from. She'd know that we'd taken care of it. And what this does is it enables the associate directors who are actually dealing with the departments to deal with the departments and not have to do an outreach effort to 50 states and 2,500 county chairmen who all want to know why their candidate hasn't gotten the job. That's what my job is. Right? So I have the Returns and Damage Merchandise Office, but that we find all those people who want to know why they didn't get the job. I have to ask, I have to answer the question. So anything from a precinct chairman to, a senator or governor, I'm charged with dealing with their offices on. On the political sense, in addition, if there was a politically sensitive appointment, I can think of a couple of times. One was we got rid of 5 SBA chairmen when SBA just came in. Chuck Heatherly got rid of 5 of them right away. And it became a politically sensitive issue, and so I was brought in to help, help them understand what their options were politically, what would happen if they did X, Y, and Z. That was my advice, and also what it looked like congressionally, what we need to do. When it came to congressional strategy in terms of confirming somebody, Senate confirmation, any of that was generally handled through Nancy Kennedy in the congressional office. So I didn't do very much of that, but I did a little bit of political strategizing.
So you did have contact with Capitol Hill in just the normal routine way, coordinating on occasion with congressional liaison?
Very occasionally. In fact, I can only think of a couple of times.
Really?
Yeah. Most of the time they did. They took care of Capitol Hill. I did mostly casework for Capitol Hill. Phil Graham's office calls and says, what about this guy? And they call back the next day, what about that guy? And they'd have a list of guys that they were concerned about. And we kept a list for each congressman and senator who called on a regular basis of what was going on with their people. So, you know, Phil Graham was involved quite a bit, and Alphonse D'Amato, Paul Laxalt, Frank Fahrenkopf, the party chairman, Jack Kemp, not as much as you would expect, Trent Lott. And so, you know, you can start to recognize the names of this. They're more prominent, Bob Dole. They, of course, have more interest in personnel matters.
You have, throughout this discussion, referred to we did this and we did that. How many people did you have under you?
I had three people under me. At the beginning, the staff was Mary Alice Willis as my secretary. She left in June, and was replaced by Julia Warner. My deputy for congressional relations was Julia Ciorletti, C-I-O-R-L-E-T-T-I. She handled all relations with Capitol Hill. She'll probably tell you the names of the administrative assistants, about all the senators on the Republican side and half the congressmen. She really has a good recollection. Eric Stahlfeld was my deputy for personnel matters. He handled all the Schedule C clearances and placements. He had probably the most remarkable knowledge of personnel of anybody in the department, with the possible exception of Tag Tagnelli, because Tag has gone through and verified each one of those people. So between Tag and Eric, they can tell you just about everything you need to know about anybody who's come through here over the last, and that's 10,000 people. I mean, they can pull a name. They literally have the capacity between them. If you ask them about a name, one or the other of them will know exactly who you're talking about, when they came through, who they are, where they come from, how many years out of college they were, if they had a grade level, what it was. And really, the two of them are remarkable that way. And Eric, I really leaned on very heavily to do the Schedule C work. He'd pull people out. I'd say, Eric, I don't even know. How do you go about looking for that? And he said, oh, I already sent three people over. And I looked at the resumes, and they're perfectly suited for the job. So I give him a lot of the credit for some of the good placements that came through. He also has the reputation of being the most brutal interview in any way. I have some people who have at least 50 IQ points on me who come out of an interview with him just shaking their head. And, you know, they tell me later, the guy was amazing. You know, he asked me questions that I had to stop and think twice, you know, and then he's just and would go never any less than 45 minutes. And he'd go issue after issue after issue, follow up on questions that they'd said before. Well, you said this, how about that? What about this, what about that? And he was just, he's great. He should definitely stay in the personnel business. This administration is far better off having him.
So, roughly, the three of you did all of this.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a heavy load.
It's very heavy load. It has its heavy spots and its light spots. I mean, we would go, I would say the office gets 100 separate incoming phone messages a day. That's not, that doesn't count. I mean, if Alphonse D'Amato's office calls us five times in a day, that's one call. Count that as one call, because it's on one matter. And so we probably were running about 100 a day on these different matters. And then you build up a backlog of people who you haven't been able to do something for. And they call all the time. So you have sometimes a senator's office calls about Joe Blow. And that's one call. But Joe Blow may call you every other day for 6 months because he's out of work. And you know, there's only so many things you can tell him. You can't say, we have no place for you, don't call us again. On the other hand, that's about... That may be the truth of the matter. That maybe there is no place for him, and he shouldn't be calling you back in. He should go home to Kansas and try and get a job there, because there's nothing here for him. You know, some people, they come here and they say, well, I'm 2 years out of college, and I want to make a BS-14. And you either have to lower their expectations, or they have to be on the job market for a while. So it got to be a heavy load. On the other hand, now we're in the period where everybody's out of town. Everybody knows not to call during August. August is light. Christmas was light. Around holidays, people say, when the president leaves, our workload drops dramatically.
You mentioned phone calls. How about correspondence? Are you getting an equal number of letters?
Most letters are addressed to Bob Tuttle. And I handle those if they're, I think, Katya could tell you better, but I think I handle about half of that. Half of the correspondence that he gets, I handle. The other half, he handles himself. At least that's what I was told. I find it hard to believe that he's able to keep up with it, because it takes quite a bit of real concentration to find out who's writing you now. But I was getting about an average, on a 7-day average, of 85 letters a day. No, that's probably wrong. That's a 5-day average, about 400 letters a week.
Why would you end up handling half of them, then? Was it because they were political in most instances?
If they're congressional, all the congressional stuff.
All the congressionals would come to you.
And all the party chairmen.
Okay. Would you be responsible for drafting responses to them, or at least following up on them in one way or another?
Most of it's automatic responses, and that would go out of Katya's shop, because she's computer and information. Occasionally, very occasionally, I would draft a response for other people's signature.
How about face-to-face meetings with folks? Were you having as many meetings in a week as you would phone calls and letters? Obviously
probably
not.
I did most of my interviewing on Tuesdays and Thursdays, because Monday, Wednesday, and Friday we have an 8:45 staff meeting with the senior staff, Bob and the associates. That would go till 9:30, and then I had a 10 to an 11 o'clock deputies meeting with all the other deputies. So, you know, you get in at 8:30 or 8 o'clock, you'll have breakfast, you get into your office at 8:30, 8:45, you're going to a meeting. You get back at 9:30, you return some of the phone calls left over from the night before. Pretty soon it's 10 o'clock, you go and you're in a deputy's meeting. Then one of the other deputies will hang around and talk to you until it's 11:15, 11:30. Your day's gone, then you got a lunch interview. And then in the afternoon you're catching up on the stuff you missed in the morning. So by the second month I pretty much figured out not to do interviews except on Tuesdays and Thursdays. During the light, there were weeks when I did no interviews at all. Just weeks where I just was empty and there weren't anybody who Eric couldn't interview by himself that I felt I needed to. There was other weeks where I did 6 interviews in a day, 3 days a week. And that's the other associate directors, probably Susan Phillips, works the hardest in terms of interviews given in the daytime. She carries a pretty level load of about 4 to 5 interviews every day of the week. 5 days a week, so she's to 20 interviews a week, 20, 25. And that's a lot. That's a lot. That's an hour, half an hour to an hour interview with somebody where you're probing their brain about every single thing you can talk about. With me, it's not so difficult, because what I would do is I'd do a 20-minute interview, meet the person, find out where they were politically, what have they done, and then I'd give them to Eric. And then Eric would rake them over the coals for an hour. And so we did the good cop, bad cop routine, and it served us very well. Eric probably carries the heaviest load of interviews besides Susan in the department. And Eric does at least as many as she does. And these are just to interview people, not for jobs, just to interview them. He would just interview them, just to interview them.
What's the distinction there?
Well, the distinction is there's a job at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and we're going to consider Ben Waldman. So then they call me in, they'd say, Ben, let's talk about X, Y, and Z, and then they'd zoom right in, let's talk about housing. A general interview is, Eric just wants to meet the guy and see how they think. And then he'd come out of the interview and he'd have notes and he'd say, this person has these views and we should definitely keep them out of these areas because they're not knowledgeable or they're not thinking straight about it. And Eric can do all, and Eric is qualified to judge people on really all of those issues. He could go from Health and Human Services, to one of their agencies like HICFA, Healthcare Finance Agency, and he can talk about the minutiae of that agency and then go to broad foreign policy, what do you think we ought to be doing in Africa? And somebody would say, well, I've never really been to Africa, but, I hear it's nice, and he'd say, okay, keep them out of foreign policy. This is not where they should be,
These interviews that you do, do you have a set of questions that you anticipate asking, to just kind of fly by the seat of your pants?
It's the same set of questions that I give everybody. It's not as formal as all that. Nobody would ever know that I've asked the same question to 200 people before them. But it turns out that I do. I ask them, first of all, I give them a little bit of background on PPO. I want to know what their expectations are of the system. And then I try and educate them so that they don't think that we're a job placement agency.
I find out what they're what they think they're qualified to do. Then I find out what they're really qualified to do. And then I try and find out what they want to do in terms of specific jobs and how much they want to make. And then I let them know in no uncertain terms that this is not our decision to make. We can help them. They could not get a job if we don't want them to get a job. That is to say, if we find out that they lied on their resume or that they're, you know, a criminal or something like that, the White House can stop an appointment that way. But that just because the White House likes them doesn't mean anything. And as long as we let them know that, then they go out with a little bit of better mind. And then once I've interviewed somebody, if I've interviewed him and Eric interviews him and he likes him, then what we would do is we'd bring their name and the resume to the deputies meeting. Everybody would get a copy of the resume. We discuss them, and they'll stay on the resume list, our list of candidates, to consider just as a tickler. It's just a tickler list. It wasn't a must place or have to find this person a job. But we'd had a list of 15 or 20 names, and it rotated. And you stayed on the list for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And if nobody had a place to send you from the vacancies that we had, and we also had lists of vacancies that we'd been considering, you just went off the list. And the thought there was that if everybody's seen your name 3 times a week for 3 weeks, and we've interviewed you, and they've sent you out, and you haven't gotten anything, then chances are you need to start fending for yourself.
Today is August 19th, 1986. This is side two of the interview with Ben Waldman. Let me ask that question again, although it's not terribly significant. At least we'll know what we're talking about. Did you do any traveling?
You know I traveled somewhere, and it must have been a significant trip because I can't think of what it was now.
Well, I'd be quite surprised if you did any traveling. Based on what you've told me up to this point, it sounds like you were
I know. I did do some. I'm sorry. I did do one trip. I went and I was... I did two trips. One very early on. I spoke as an alumni at my college, Claremont Men's College, and I spoke there. And the other trip, I was up in Pennsylvania. I was invited by some high schools in northeastern Pennsylvania to lecture on personnel, and I did. I went to 9 high schools in 2 days and spoke up in the Wilkes-Barre area, and that was fun. That was a lot of fun. Campaign person, and I've done a lot of traveling and speaking, but that was an exhausting trip. I was scheduled to go on one trip in October, but I'm obviously not going.
Well, the job that you had doesn't lend itself well to travel. The people come to you, you don't go to them.
Although I would recommend, if I ever speak to the person who heads personnel in the next administration, I would recommend that they take the whole office on the road and go out to the states, because it's a tremendous burden to people who... I mean, you have somebody who's worked, in Ronald Reagan's case, in 1976, and then they worked in 1984, and then they worked in 1984, and over the course of the time, they've put in man hours equal to $30,000 or $40,000. But they may not have that kind of money to donate. Now, somebody who's given that kind of money has no trouble getting access to presidential personnel. People who've given $40,000 over the course of a few years, we know their names, they don't have the expense, no problem. They fly into Dulles. They stay at the Madison Hotel, they have their limousine take them over here, and we spend 2 hours with them. But the person who stuffed envelopes for $40,000 worth of time for us, we don't know their name, and they don't have the ability to come back here and sit at a hotel or anywhere else for a month waiting for us to get around to see them. So I would recommend that upon somebody taking over presidential personnel, that they go out to each of the states and set up in a central city for 2 days, so anybody who wants to apply to the state chairman or the county chairman to get an interview from the White House can do that. It just seems it would be the more equitable thing to do.
You mentioned the number of days a week that you worked just casually. I'd like to zero in on that. Was it 5 days a week? Was it 7 days a week?
It was 7 to begin with. I was in here every day for the first 5 months.
Was that because of the backlog then, or simply just to get you up to speed?
Mostly to get me up to speed. I had come from an agency, and I had come from Department of Housing and Urban Development, where if I got 6 phone calls a day, it was a heavy day. And where we started the workday at 9 o'clock and ended at 5:30, and that was also a long day. So then to come over here where you're at, you know, 40 phone messages at lunchtime, you get backlogged. And so I was not getting any work, affirmative, positive work done during the daytime. So, for instance, all my correspondence work I did during the weekend, you know, in terms of signing off the letters. Going through my inbox, my outbox, all my reading, I never got any reading done during the week. And just in my job, you have to read, you know, I was reading National Journal, occasionally Congressional Quarterly, my newspapers, you know, National Review, Conservative Digest, occasionally, you know, all the Heritage Briefing papers. By the time you got done with that, you're at 6 hours of reading. So I came in on the weekends to get that done. I cut that back right after the first of the year because my wife had a baby and I was wanting to spend some time at home. So I went to a, I didn't used to work too much on Sundays. I would come in on Saturdays. Ironically, one of the things that put me back on the schedule of working 7 days was when I started working for the softball team. And I was the captain of the softball team, and we got into ordering shirts, and so all that stuff I didn't want to do during the work week, so I would come in on Sundays, and I would spend all my Sundays, you know, doing what is generally nonsensical work, but was very good for the morale of, you know, the people around here. We had a good team. So 6 days a week, for the most part. 8:30 to 6:30.
So you were able to leave roughly around 6:30?
Yeah, most of the time, although when I say leave, I still was here, but I did a lot of tours, a lot of West Wing tours. I would say that we were probably looking over the first 4 months at doing four nights a week, and then I started to get smart, started to put them together. Again, I did, like I do my interviews on Tuesday, Thursdays, I just refused to do them four, so I do them three nights a week. So, you know, on those nights, then I got out of here at 8 o'clock. But, I mean, I wasn't at my desk. I was over in the West Wing giving tours. But that was the job of the political, you know, again, I was the political representative, so I always felt it was a lot easier to give a tour or get a set of cufflinks for somebody than to try and get them a job, because, you know, sometimes you just can't.
You mentioned the interaction between yourself and the immediate members of the presidential personnel staff. How about other members of the White House? How much contact would you have had with them?
Minimal. Yeah.
So your contact was literally to people on the outside, mm-hmm. outreach. And while you were contacting those folks, you were also having contact with the departments and agencies also.
Rarely. Yeah, that was most the other associate directors did that. I would contact their deputies. The rule was in President Personnel, I could not actually call a department or agency unless I asked the other associate director first. And since it was all, since if I was going to make the call to ask them, I figured I'd just ask their deputy and let their deputy do the footwork, and that's generally what we did.
Did you keep any sort of a log of your activities on a daily basis?
I keep a personal notebook. I log all my phone calls outgoing, and I log some of my interviews. But I also take all my personal notes. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a personal notebook like you carry with you. Nothing really in the office. They have an office calendar that we use sporadically. I'm not the best organized person. They always had a hard time keeping up with me that way. But there is a schedule. I was better the last couple of months than I was during the first 10.
At the Reagan Presidential Library, what would a researcher expect to find of your input and your responsibilities? Will there be much documentation?
All the letters to Congress, I mean, for the last 11 months, all they'll see from PPO are letters from me to congressmen, and they'll all look the same. Thanks for your letter recommending, you know, letter to Don Regan recommending this person. As you know, we have far many more qualified candidates than we can handle, blah, 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 blah. They'll see a lot of that. I don't think they'll see much else.
So the interviews you did, you didn't finalize or formalize any sort of a write-up afterwards?
No. You have to be careful on what you put down in writing. Because what if I say somebody is... you know, I could write down somebody has, but was aggressive in the interview. They were unique in their attention to, you know, details. That were very self-promoting, blah, blah. Those can be taken in all sorts of different kinds of ways. And, you know, it's not very useful to somebody else if they don't understand the person who took the notes. So it can be more harmful than good.
So that information that you collected from the interviews, you would have passed on orally in the course of maybe the deputies' meetings or what have you.
That's right.
So in effect, Ben Waldman's tracks won't be very prominent at the presidential library in years to come.
No.
But based on what you're saying, there would not have been any Schedule C person during this 11-month span that you were here that would have been hired without having, in one way or another, come through your office and with whom you would have had contact.
That's right. And I may not have personally have interviewed them, because, for instance, somebody could have been interviewed before I came, and then we'd have the vacancy form, and we'd say, oh, this is a good person, and we'd send their name over. But we'd call them to let them know, and then they would get interviewed and hired. And I may never have seen them. Well, I will tell you this. There was, during the time I was here, every Schedule C person in the entire government, SES and non-SES, was invited to a briefing that I held, in which I addressed. We had five or six of them, and we invited them agency by agency. Of the, I think we had over 1,000 people attending. I think about 1,100 people attended, of the 3,000 or so that we invited. And I spoke to all of them.
What was the purpose of this briefing?
Mainly to have them into the White House to tell them we appreciated what they were doing out there, to talk to them.
Hi, gentlemen.
Matt.
Hi,
Kitchen. I've got an interview going here.
Oh, come on.
Well, for the sake of the interview, Matt McGuire has just walked into the office.
Uninvited. He didn't walk in. He barged in.
I know this guy, too, so...
He barged in. He just
I barged
stormed in.
I'll leave.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay.
Good to see you.
All right.
He's getting ready to leave. That's why I'm doing this little interview, Matt.
Well,
to find out who he was, what he did.
Well, if I let you go, then maybe you'd free you up a little sooner. What are we talking about? Is there anything I can comment
on? Well,
I'll
tell you what. Maybe after I get through with Ben and he leaves, I'll call you up and say, now, Matt,
what
here's
exactly
what he told me.
No. Right in front of him.
Right in front
of him. I do business, you know, that way. None of this.
Well, I don't know what to say. Well, I take it you came in maybe to talk about, a lock on the vault door over there?
I thought if I caught you at a good time, we'd go over and take a look at it, but I don't think I did.
We're not going to be much longer.
No, I wouldn't think so either. You want me to call you?
I'm going to run over there.
Are you?
Why don't we do it tomorrow morning?
Okay.
Okay.
Stop by.
Okay.
Fair enough.
You're not going to be doing an interview tomorrow morning?
I think this one with Ben will be over
by
then.
See ya.
See you later, Matt.
So these interviews with these...
These were interviews, were meet and greets. Bob Tuttle would generally start them off. Then Mitch Daniels would generally give a political briefing, what was going on. Then we had Jack Svahn do a couple of them. Rod McDaniel was scheduled to do one. Rod McDaniel did do one. He was supposed to, Admiral Poindexter was supposed to give the national security briefing. He didn't. Rod McDaniel did. Larry Speaks gave a few of them. The highlight of the briefings was always Pat Buchanan. He spoke at all of them, and he was brilliant at all of them. And then I had the unlucky task of following him, and then I would close them. And I generally told them that we were very helpful. We were very thankful of what they did. We understood the kinds of problems they had out in the agencies, and that we were thankful that they did the good fighting that they did out there to fight for the president's program. And we thanked them, and then they would, you know, take off.
Do you have a record of who was invited, who actually showed
mm-hmm.
up? Do you have any sort of a recording of
Eric the, Stahlfeld would know.
What he, okay. mm-hmm. Did they tape any of these, Ben?
No. I don't think so.
You did it up in, 450 or the Indian Treaty?
450.
450.
Yeah, we never asked for them to be taped.
How about magazine or newspaper articles about you specifically? Did your name appear in print very often?
Never. Nope. Just a little obit, like in the Washington Times when they thought I was leaving last week, just say that I was leaving.
You've already told me that there were typical days and then there were untypical days, so I won't bother to go over that question again. That's one that generally is interesting. Was there any one event or topic or experience that you had that stands head and shoulders above all the rest? Some people say, no, there's no way I can answer that. And in other instances, someone will say, you know, there was one meeting that I attended or what have you.
I would have to say that one event generally stands head and shoulder above all the rest, and that was any time that I was able to get a glimpse of the president himself in the flesh. And it happened several times. One time I was walking into the mess and he was coming out of the NSC room, and he brushed by me, you know, as he was going by. One time I was on the fifth floor of the EOB coming down, he was coming to speak to me in the entry room. A couple of times he was leaving, you know, to go at Camp David. A couple of times I was out at the Southwest Gate, he was going on a motorcade. You know, any time when I was near the president, all of the kind of the petty instances of, you know, backbiting or frustration or, you know, complication, they'd all melt away, because then I'd realize this is why I was doing it. It was for this man who's the president, and he's the greatest president. And so, in a sense, that was the one, you know, it was the one thing that always was great. And whenever the president would be near, it was always great. You recharge your batteries.
Yeah. Let's say 15 years from now, a researcher out at the library wants to track you down to ask you some more questions about perhaps even some of the people that were selected or some that weren't, and if so, why. How would you suggest they try and find you?
Tell them to put a big ad in the Washington Post saying they've got a round-trip ticket for me to Stanford, and I'll contact them immediately. The easiest way to get a hold of me would be to go to Claremont Men's College, ask the alum office. The alum office will always know where I am.
Do you anticipate returning to California?
No.
Do you think you'll stay back here on the East Coast?
My wife's parents are here, and I love it back here. I love the East Coast.
But you grew up in California?
Grew up in Claremont.
In Claremont. Ben, those are the questions that I generally try to touch upon in the course of an interview. If there's something that you had anticipated being asked about and were all prepared to answer and I failed to ask it, by all means, I turn the podium over to you, so to speak. Mm-hmm. If not, if you think we've covered things fairly well, then we'll call it quits.
I think that's a good interview.
Well, I take that as a compliment after having heard what you did all the time. Thank you.